Rodney has worked with Tech in the parametallurgy division since 1985. He holds a BSc engineering degree in chemical engineering from WITS, as well as a BA degree in logic and philosophy from UNISA, as well as a master's degree in engineering metallurgy from WITS University. He's a registered professional engineer, a fellow and council member of the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy, a fellow of the South African Institute of Chemical Engineers, and a full member of the Computer Society of South Africa. He was a visiting professor at the Center for Pyrometallurgy at the University of Missouri-Rolla during July and August 1996, and in 2002 and 2003 he also lectured in Australia at Murdoch University. The National Research Foundation rated him in 2009 as an internationally acclaimed researcher, so he awarded him an honorary life fellowship in 2010. Rodney is also a member of the board of trustees for onemind.org. He's married with two children, so he's human as well. His main interests being computer simulation and design of high temperature processes and the development of thermodynamic software like Pyrosim, which is, as you know, quite popular and is used in 22 countries around the world. He's also one of the inventors of the Conrose process, which has, up to now, demonstrated DC arc smelting of PGM concentrates in excess of 50,000 tons. Rodney.
Thanks very much for the introduction, and good to see that I'm amongst friends this afternoon. It's actually lovely to see so many familiar faces here. It really does set one at ease to talk at a session like this one at the end of the afternoon. It's a difficult thing to know quite what to say when you're scheduled at the end of a day of presentations like this. So many people are working in a field that has grown a lot over the last few decades that by now, surely it's all been said. So I hope you'll indulge me in a trip somewhat down memory lane, basically as far back as I can remember, and then some, just to show kind of where this field of pyrometallurgical modeling has really come from, to set the scene for the next presentation, which will be more open-ended, and where is it going to? Just one second. Anyway, the story really is set down in our little southern tip of Africa, where smelting has been around for many hundreds of years. Since the Stone Age in the Witwatersrand area, people have been smelting iron, at very least, in furnaces that look pretty much like the one shown here in this photograph from 1888. Of course, many things have changed. At Mintek, that's the current state of the art, certainly a far cry from the previous photograph. Other supporting technologies have changed a lot as well. At one time, hard to believe, this was the state-of-the-art equipment that could be used to try and understand processes going on. Clearly things have moved on somewhat. Today's portable high-speed digital cameras running at hundreds of thousands of frames a second are certainly a far cry from the previous image of the 1800s. The picture on the bottom right is of the first ENIAC computer post-World War II. Again, state-of-the-art back then. Personally, I prefer what's on my desktop right today. However, I'm very glad to have been born and brought up in the time period that I was, because it exposed me to a wide range of technologies. Amongst some in the audience, by the nods that I'm seeing, are those who will recall, like I do, not with warm fondness, I don't expect, the use of log tables dating back to school days. That's how multiplication was done in the old days, guys. Hard to believe. Fortunately, as I say, my timing was good. I didn't have to suffer that for too long. I did get given a slide rule, and that was a mammoth step forward. Fortunately, that didn't last too long either, and it was time for me to be given the first scientific calculator in my high school. It was quite a big improvement, let me tell you. Of course, by the time university started for me, it was back to the punch cards that we heard about earlier. Yeah, they're still real, and I do still have one set of them on my bookshelf just for old time's sake. I don't miss programming like that, though. Syntax errors were pretty common, pretty prevalent, and it was quite a rigmarole to get your big bunch of cards, and boy, if you dropped them, that was it, over. You'll never get them sorted again. Then, of course, things moved on, and this was, for me, quite a leap forward to a programmable calculator. This particular device had nearly 1 kilobyte of RAM. Can you believe it? 960 program steps of assembly language. And with that, I was able to design heat exchangers, cyclones, and actually have reusable programs. It was life-changing, actually. Then came time for my working career to begin at Mintec. And now, this isn't a mistake. That is pretty much what my desk looked like in my first year of working. Those who know me well know my desk doesn't look like that anymore, sadly. Anyway, I made quite a nuisance of myself in my first year at Mintec, begging and pleading for these, you know, some kind of computing device, because I really knew the potential and this was something I loved doing. So at the end of the year, our divisional secretary very proudly and tongue-in-cheek presented with me with my first computer at Mintec. Fortunately, soon thereafter, I got an Apple II, and with that, I was able to develop the early pyrometallurgical programming that we did at Mintec. As you can see, it came with not merely one, but two floppy disk drives, each of which had the capacity of normally 180 kilobytes, but if you were really clever, you could put another notch in the opposite side and flip them over. As long as the quality control was reasonable, you could actually get double usage. So you could start it up with booting up with the operating system on one side, quickly flip it over before it had time to realize that the program now needed to load as well. And you could actually run like that. It's quite astounding, actually, if you think back on it. What we assume these days. Of course, one or two have crossed my desktop since those days. I've also had the opportunity to visit the Minnesota Supercomputer Center, and this is really just the sort of kickoff for the next presentation. I got to see the Cray 1 supercomputer, invented by Seymour Cray, shown on the right. Fortunately, maybe his taste in suits didn't last quite as long as the taste in supercomputers. And this machine, developed in 1976, ran at an astonishing 80 megahertz, 80 times faster than my little Apple II at least, and that's on every processing step that was happening. It had a massive 8 megabytes of memory, and it only weighed 5.5 tons. I mean, this was nearly portable. It did require 250 kilowatts, so it almost qualified as a pyrometallurgical unit all on its own. One of the amazing things about Minnesota is that it's a very, very cold place. I visited in the dead of winter, temperatures at minus 22 degrees Celsius, and all you see is steam coming out of a lot of the buildings. In fact, the heating for the supercomputer center was generated largely from the cooling circuits that were required to run the supercomputers. They were buried underneath what's the very nice little seating arrangement around the edge of the computer. So you even had a nice warm place to sit and think while you're solving your supercomputing problems. The Cray 1 is still in use today, as far as I understand. It's now very cool, quirky perhaps, lounge furniture, not used for its supercomputing capabilities any longer. But enough of the background technology, and back to the real story of what we were doing back in the mid-1980s. At that time, Mintec was very focused on ferroalloys. We had a number of pilot plant furnaces, ranging from the 100 kVA tilting pot DC arc furnace that many in the audience will recognize. The one-ton-an-hour DC arc furnace pilot plant really was the current state of the art back then, commissioned in 1984. And at that time, a lot of the process development that was being done was essentially largely by trial and error, assisted perhaps by the odd Ellingham diagram for this one showing the free energy of formation of metallic oxides, I kind of rate this as somewhere between the log table and slide rule kind of era, comparatively, I guess. But fortunately, the mathematics and thermodynamics didn't really change. That's been well established for a very long time. There is a collection of very useful mathematical quantities that are measurable. There's the principle of energy conservation, the principle of increasing entropy, so-called first and second laws of thermodynamics. They've been around a very long time. It's also pretty easy mathematically to describe the calculation of enthalpy, entropy, and Gibbs free energy relative to the elements in their standard states at a fixed temperature and pressure. However, it is a bit laborious, remembering the computing tools that were prevalent at that time. Bearing in mind the words of Leibniz as well, who says it's unworthy of excellent men to lose hours like slaves in the labor of calculation, I couldn't agree more. So it was time to develop some software and some databases for handling this thermodynamic data, and that's really where the original thermo software concept came from, looking at a database of a small set of numbers that describe the coefficients for the calculation of enthalpy, entropy, and Gibbs free energy, and CP. And that worked fine for individual species on their own. The next stage was to take it to a more intelligent passing of chemical reactions, that you could actually tell it what the reaction or process was that you're wanting to calculate, and it would then do the necessary thermodynamic calculations. Then led on to the more complex approach within a year or so of Pyrosim, which is really a sequential modular steady-state simulator specifically for pyrometallurgical processes. The historical background to the development of the software was that, oddly enough, there has never been a project at Mintec registered for the development of the software. It always just simply piggybacked on an existing project to try and simulate and understand the production of raw stainless steel. But fortunately, the programming tools that were developed were kept sufficiently general that it could be applied and reapplied and reapplied in many other fields. Programming started back in 1985 on a 64 kilobyte Apple II computer. The work was presented really for the first time in an international conference at the APCOM conference that was held in Johannesburg in 1987. And the software was then first actually let loose into industry back in 1988. Over the next decade or so, there was about a 1,500-fold increase in speed and storage capacity, going at that stage from an Apple II to the currently then fast Pentium-based computers. At that stage, after having gone through many different programming languages, starting off in Fortran, a bit of assembly, Pascal along the way, even a bit of Prolog and other strange things like Forth and APL, I then settled on a structured and compiled version of BASIC that happened to be very fast for numerical processing, the PowerBASIC DLL compiler. So really what we saw was 1985, the software developed on the Apple II, 1988 saw the MS-DOS version, and it's still something of a surprise to me today that the software developed that long ago on an MS-DOS type platform is still actually in limited demand. Every year there's another two or three people from somewhere in the world who say, please can we have one? And it becomes an increasing challenge actually to support something that old and that long in the tooth. But by now there are 90 installed sites in 22 countries and 6 continents of the world. And it really has been one of the most satisfying things, actually, to interact. I mean, for me, one of the big surprises, really, before I got familiar with the world of ferroalloys, was that there would be some smelting activity in a place like Iceland. Iceland, for real? And somebody actually talked to me from that part of the world? It was an amazing thing. This is in the days before email was prevalent. Contact with people overseas was a matter of writing a letter and perhaps getting a reply back a month later. Whereas today, the world is a far more connected place. The principles that were involved, embedded into Pyrosim, were really based on the minimization of free energy. And I think there's been enough spoken about that, or implied about that, in previous things, not to go into too much of the details. Other than to say that individual chemical reactions don't need to be considered, all that one needs to solve this mathematically is a list of the species and the phases that are present at equilibrium. Gunnar Eriksson from Sweden developed the original and best method. There were a number of competing ones back in the 1970s, 1980s, and a lot of people were looking at this mathematical problem of how to solve free energy minimization. I guess I was fortunate in that I believe I picked the right one to back at the time. I was also fortunate enough to meet Gunnar Eriksson. I beat him at table tennis one day, so there you go. he developed a method using undetermined Lagrange multipliers to take this non-linear optimization problem and linearize it in an iterative scheme. That turned out to be very robust and reliable, with a very small number of equations actually that needed to be solved. You could bring in a whole number of additional chemical species without actually really substantially changing the computing burden at all. And this is back in the days of even big university-based codes like the FACT system that at the time only supported 8 component calculations. So something clearly had to be done for real-world pyrometallurgical problems. But fortunately, it was easy enough to do that. Then came the whole approach of how do we deal with these non-ideal solutions that are so prevalent in pyrometallurgical systems. And it's all very well if you have non-ideal solution models, but there weren't that many of them prevalent at that time. So a useful shortcut technique that was developed by a couple of people called Hasty and Bonnell advocated this idea of ideal mixing of complex components, where you can approximate solutions as mixtures of known chemical compounds, which don't really have to be actually present. You can just, you know, calculate it as though they were. And the equilibrium mole fractions of the uncomplexed components are equivalent to the activities. So, for example, in a ternary system, you may well have 14 species that you can introduce, each of which has a corresponding chemical reaction that you would need to write if you were to do this the old longhand way. But you can add all of them together, and then that approximation actually gives you a surprisingly good way of modeling non-idealities for systems that aren't already very well known. So, for example, the example shown here, if you plot the activity versus the mole fraction of a particular component cutting a slice through this ternary system at a particular fixed temperature, you can see the ideal line would be a diagonal 45-degree line shown in red. The bottom two curves, which are almost indistinguishable, are the experimental data for this particular system and the calculated one using this ideal mixing of complex components approach. And that allowed us to go into new systems that we really didn't understand and were not well documented at the time. We were able to simulate a number of units using PyroSim, some to a greater degree of accuracy than others, but really we tried it on just about everything that looked as though it could be modeled. The other big development, I suppose, that ran in parallel to all of this was the commercial FACT system. FACT stands for the Facility for the Analysis of Chemical Thermodynamics, that had been around since the late 1970s. Now, Mintec got an online connection to that in 1985, and it was quite fun back then. In the days before the commercial internet, we had to use a serial connection via a dumb terminal using the SAPONET packet data switched technique for getting across. And I can still remember part of the first line of signing onto this thing. It was C03024574, and then it gets a little bit hazy in my memory, but that is still embedded in my memory from those days. And that was basically, hello, computer out there at McGill University, are you there? Can you respond to me? Because back then, although FACT was developed at Ecole Polytechnique in Montreal, it was actually housed on a mainframe at McGill University, just down the road from them. But it was hugely expensive to run calculations, and certainly not a practical thing just to quickly do a calculation online. It was just unaffordable. And really, until the mid-1980s, that was the model for interacting, where large thermodynamic databases existed in a couple of places around the world, Sweden, the UK, Australia, Canada, the USA, on remote mainframe computers. It was really the 1990s that saw the decade, really, of the powerful personal computers, where people expected to have local software and databases available to them all of the time. Of course, the other big trend since then has been the advent of the internet, which allows people not only to advertise software, to support software, to provide updates to the whole model of almost reminiscent of connecting back to a large mainframe. Cloud computing is not that different in a sense, except the reliability is much greater these days than it ever was then. The FACT system integrated a number of other packages and became known as FACTSAGE, has a wonderful set of multi-component non-ideal solution models. Again, I don't think we need to focus on the details of that particularly. Other areas that I just want to touch on that we've also done that I believe have some lasting significance in this development of pyrometallurgical simulation. Some came about from the work that was done on looking at the relationship between recoveries of cobalt and iron. And that was fortunately able to be generalized into what's become known as the K-gamma or recovery equation that really describes as the extent of reduction in a particular system can be mapped to the recovery of any particular element. Iron is chosen for the fact that it's common, prevalent, and everybody understands it. And you can then relate the recovery of any other element of interest to that. And it's a very good way of abstracting the data and understanding a system without having to go through the minute particularities of each particular situation. This is a common trend that can be drawn out of a huge amount of data for nickel, for cobalt, for chromium, even for PGMs. The other work that I just wanted to mention, but you'll hear more about that, is not only on the chemical side, but a valuable part of modeling the process actually needs to model the energy source that goes into it as well. And so a huge amount of work has been done over the years on the photography and modeling of DC arcs in particular. Other areas where I think there's been a contribution and a important sort of trend, I suppose, is that towards not only doing the modeling, developing the techniques, but now actually making information available to people. And again, an important development in the age of the internet is how you can actually take that forward. So I guess just to conclude, the laws of thermodynamics have been around a long time and provide a very elegant mathematical expression of some usefully measurable facts. Software makes it easy to do thermodynamic calculations without requiring the slave labor. If you refer the calculations to a particular reference state of the elements at 25 degrees Celsius and 1 atmosphere, it allows all the calculations of these state functions to be path independent and to be related to a nice common basis where you don't have to look at individual chemical reactions to describe a system. Equilibrium compositions can be calculated very efficiently by free energy minimization, and we've seen that good solution models are becoming available. Thank you very much.